Rogers International over FM 102 KLRB. And now back to Mae Brussel.
The Associated Press had a story today that the Heritage Foundation is advising Ronald Reagan that we've never had so much chaos in this country or threat to internal security to the Republic since World War II. They're suggesting that he take a hard line against domestic radicals, that they revive the Congressional Internal Security Committee, that they influence conservative research groups, and they have a blueprint to step up activities. They want to go against the radicals, the new left, the anti-defense, the anti-nuclear lobbies. They also mentioned the white racists like the Ku Klux Klan. There's no mention of the American Nazi Party. This is the article I mentioned before that asked that they stop restricting opening mail by the FBI, that they don't need the approval of the president or the attorney general for break-ins, and that nobody of a political, no groups in political organizations can be investigated unless they're suspected of criminal activity. And, of course, the catch-22 there is that it's not criminal if it's national security. So you can expect a lot of excitement in the near future, and also I believe there'll be a Reichstag kind of operation to convince Ronald Reagan that there is chaos. At the time of the SWAT team emerging during our dinner hour to show their new expertise at the SLA were burned in Los Angeles, the headlines a few weeks later said SWAT teams will be needed for food riots. As I say, when the food gets too high, when people are unemployed and you put a lid on new employment and you have no low-cost housing, that's one of the new restrictions they want to take away, is demanding that the builders provide low-cost housing and so forth. When you have no housing and no food and no transportation and no medical care, you can expect riots. And these people want to be prepared. There's nothing going on out in the streets such as they're describing, but they will create the need and then say, see, we told you so. There have been a lot of articles, as I say, on Ronald Reagan's think tanks, the two of them, the Hoover Institute and the Georgetown University. I want to talk about one of the people at Georgetown University who's helping Ronald Reagan get his committee and his Congress together, not his Congress, but his cabinet and advisors. Georgetown is pleased. They have 15 advisors, as I say, from their school, 22 from Stanford. The director, the man who's helping, the expert on strategic studies at Georgetown University is Edward N. Luttwak, L-U-T-T-W-A-K. He was trained at the London School of Economics and Johns Hopkins, and he has been talking about advising Ronald Reagan. He first was an advisor to Howard Baker of the CIA, and now he's advising Ronald Reagan on foreign and defense policy, and he's become the expert for the Georgetown Center for Strategic and International Studies. You'll see that CSIS a lot in the news from now on. It is a think tank that produced two-thirds of Ronald Reagan's advisors, and they're in Washington, D.C. on 18th Street. And Luttwak, according to the Washington Post, wrote a book on the strategy of the Roman Empire and an analysis of current defense capability. Now, it's interesting that the Washington Post attributes Luttwak's expertise to the strategy of the Roman Empire, but they didn't mention that he wrote a book called Coup d'etat in America. The minute I saw his name helping Ronald Reagan, I recognized Edward Luttwak, and while certain people thought of him as a folk hero when Coup d'etat came out in 1969, I realized that he was somebody to be afraid of. I think it was Penn Jones in Texas who thought, oh, Coup d'etat is a great book, and everybody talked about Coup d'etat. Luttwak wrote a practical handbook on how to overthrow countries. The book, the table of contents, what is a coup d'etat? When is it possible? The strategy of the coup d'etat, the planning, the execution, the economics of repression. He's from Georgetown University. Now, I thought it was interesting. He wrote this in 1969 when the United States had its coup d'etat in 1963, November 22nd. But he never mentioned the assassination of John Kennedy. In this book, The Coup d'Etat, he said he has a section on how to take over a nation, and it's described in the cover as a cold-blooded detail, the whole strategy of taking over a country. Every step of the takeover is covered, from a preliminary look at modern states to the final triumphant entry into a capital whose airports have been closed, whose leaders have been arrested if not already recruited, whose police and military are neutralized, whose population has been left with no course but to accept the fait accompli. Oh, Coup d'Etat in America was the book by A.J. Weberman on the assassination of John Kennedy. Coup d'Etat is the book by Luttwak, put out by Alfred Knopf in 1969. In this book, he says every stage of planning and action is worked out on what to do, when to do it, and how, and the methods of sounding out your minimum risk, your timing, your intelligence, and so forth. Luttwak was born in Transylvania. I thought that was where Dracula came from. I guess they both were from there. Educated in Italy and Britain, London School of Economics, studied in the Middle East, East and West, and then shows up as one of the leaders at Georgetown University as an advisor to Ronald Reagan. In his book, he lists certain coups d'etats that took place from 1945 to 1967. Now, that was the time period right after World War II when the OSS became instrumental and began to get their muscles, and then the CIA was formed by 1947 with the help of Reinhard Gehlen, Hitler's chief of intelligence. And then the United States was gung-ho from 47 up to the present day. There was a coup in Guinea-Bissau yesterday that I want to go into. But in Coup d'Etat, he describes the coup in Algeria. Now, every one of these coups was a right-wing military coup with the assistance of the United States in Algeria in 1964, Burundi in 1958, and in 66, the Central African Republic in 1965, the Congo in 58, the Congo in 1964. One was the Brazzaville Congo, and the other was the Kinshasa. Egypt in 1965, that's when Sadat took over from Nasser. Ghana in 1965, Nigeria 1965, Rwanda in 58, Sierra Leone in 65, Sudan in 65, Togo in 65. See, John Kennedy and the coup took place in 1963, almost before 1964, but Burma was 1963. These were the successful coup d'etats, and he became an expert and wrote a book on how to do it. He has the right-wing faction in Laos in 64, in Nepal, Thailand, the army factions, and Vietnam Republic, November 1st, 1963. That was 30 days before John Kennedy was murdered, when Diem was murdered in Southeast Asia by our government. He has murders in Iraq, the coup in 1963, Lebanon, Syria, Africa, and he goes into various countries and coup d'etats. And he has not only been an expert on this, the one in Thailand in 1965, the Vietnam Republic in 1965, Korea in 1965, and their various struggles, Argentine, the coup in 1965, Bolivia in 58, Brazil, he has 65, actually it was in 1964, right after Kennedy was murdered, the Dominican Republic and Ecuador, El Salvador, Guatemala, Haiti, Honduras, Nicaragua, Panama, Paraguay, Peru, all of these coup d'etats are listed with the dates. I once had a figure of 77 countries that the United States had been instrumental in putting military dictatorships in, and we hear about the Soviet Union's influence in Cuba and the necessity to overturn all of Central America. These few dinky little islands have a communist form of government, and now Jamaica is far right-wing, and it belongs to Ronald Reagan and a Harvard graduate. These coups are listed in this book, Coup d'Etat. We don't have to list all of the countries for you, the 77. Edouard Luttwak, The Practical Handbook on How to Do a Military Takeover So the People Are Left Totally Immobilized. That's what happened to us November 22nd, 1963. And now he is from the Georgetown think tank sending advisors to Ronald Reagan. They knew how to do it, and they did it really good. One of the things that I mentioned rather angrily, and you'll hear me being angry many times or disgusted, was the passivity of the so-called left and the Kennedy team, or the non-voters, the 50% that didn't vote in this last election, or the so-called liberals behind miserable scumbags like Javits in New York, the liberal behind Jan Anderson. I can't imagine where these people are coming from, but there is no left in this country. It's been completely annihilated. There will be radical, angry people out in the streets someday, but there is no organized left. As I say, if there's anything, it's an intellectual group that sit at the desks, such as those that attended the conference on John Kennedy and his vision and goals, and not one of those, the Schlesingers and Salingers and the Bill Moyers and the whole gang of people that look like they are concerned thinkers, are complete washouts to facing the reality of what happened in this country. I much more respect a far right-wing conservative than a jelly-belly liberal who sees both sides but doesn't believe in anything. An example of that, going from Reagan's advisor, Litwack, to a person who recognizes some of the realities, is the other side of the coin, a man, Medford Evans, graduate of Yale, a member of the Birch Society, wrote a book called The Usurpers. Some of his theories are wrong, not all of them are right, but in apropos or in conjunction with the anniversary of Kennedy's death, I'm not going to read you what the so-called left or Kennedy friends wrote. All of the books they wrote don't even touch the murder. But it took Medford Evans from the far right wing to write about the coup in 1963. He wrote in The Usurpers about Dean Rusk, Walter Rostow, Robert McNamara, Clark Clifford, Abe Fortas, and Nicholas Katzenbach. And I want to read a few pages from his book, The Usurpers. He said, at some time after November 5th, 1968, that was the election when Richard Nixon was won the nomination and won the election in November of 68, we will know whether the usurpers of the type who are operating the present administration are to continue in power or to be replaced by establishment substitutes. We'll know if the usurpers win. Well, Richard Nixon won, and he was very much a part of that early assassination team. Medford Evans wrote Chapter 2 of The Usurpers, The Coup d'etat of November 22, 1963. Now, Medford Evans saw it. Why wouldn't Mr. Litwack have seen in 69 that we had a coup d'etat in 63? This is what Medford Evans wrote. Exactly who put Lyndon Baines Johnson into the White House in 63 is not known. The Warren Commission said it was Lee Harvey Oswald. Various persons, such as New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, author Mark Lane, disagree. Whoever killed John Kennedy evidently wanted Lyndon Johnson to become a president. And my book deals with well-established matters of fact and with certain obvious conjectures. Natural speculation is presented, but presented as speculation. It is a matter of fact that Lyndon Johnson failed to secure the nomination for president in 1960. It is a matter of reasonable conjecture that afterwards there was little chance of being nominated unless he achieved it through the president dying in office. It is a matter of fact that in November 1963, he had been vice president for three trying years with nothing to do except self-discipline and patience. And since the president in whose shadow Johnson served was 9 years younger, the odds were great that he would never become president unless Kennedy were killed. Indeed, there was some prospect in November 1963 that Johnson may not even continue to be vice president and would go to relative obscurity as being an ex-vice president. William Manchester referred to persistent reports that Johnson may be dumped off the ticket next year. Arthur Schlesinger wrote about it, and Johnson did not attend a meeting of high officials in November 63 to support this idea. He says, once we conclude, as so many reasonable writers have shown, that the report of the Warren Commission is inherently incredible, we can hardly suppress speculation that someone on the commission intended a deception. Now, John J. McCloy, one of the advisors to the interim team, he's 80 years old, the advisor to Ronald Reagan, was on the Warren Commission. Gerald Ford was on the Warren Commission. Arlene Specter, a lawyer for the Warren Commission staff, has been elected to the Senate in Washington, D.C. Medgar Evans quoted Richard Rovere, a writer who said the commission's client was Lyndon Johnson, and the day the Warren report was issued, the American press should have begun to do what Mr. Edward Epstein did in writing a book. They should have cast a cool eye on the Warren report. Now, the American press didn't begin the day the report was out to examine it. I began, and other researchers began, but they didn't. What Medgar Evers wrote is, what is not speculation is that the death of John Kennedy affected a transfer of power in the United States. Every assassination of a chief of state is, in effect, a coup d'etat. A coup d'etat is not a revolution. It does not necessarily involve a change in ideology. It does not necessarily involve a change in bureaucracy or professional police. A coup d'etat is accomplished by someone already near the highest level. If an assassin is too far beneath his victim in the established power structure, he can't reap the fruit of his deed. The fruit will, however, be gathered. And I might add, the fruit of Leon Jaworski and John Connolly, another advisor, and Gerald Ford, with their riches and their prominence, has been gathered from their covering up this death. Medgar Evers went on, an assassin may not intend to seize power for himself. He may not be thinking in terms of power at all, but someone will be thinking in those terms. A coup d'etat, unlike a revolution, does not involve a large number of people. A coup d'etat such as the November 22, 1963, did involve hundreds of people, but that's not large when you think of 200 million in the United States. Its success depends on the majorities continuing to operate pretty much in their accustomed fashion. The pilot must be replaced with as little disturbance as possible to the passenger. On reflection, most people will believe that the assassination of John Kennedy, so difficult to execute, so dangerous to the murderer, must have been planned. And since the victim was President of the United States, few will doubt that the planners were politically motivated. America in general would not believe that, as Sergeant Shriver said, that people of Asia, Africa, and America would believe that the motivation was anything but supreme power. He said, there was a quotation of Shriver's, that's Kennedy's brother-in-law, about the killing of John Kennedy that he didn't agree with. Shriver said that Asia, Africa, and South America would assume that whoever had killed President Kennedy would now be president. He doesn't agree with that necessarily, but he has to say in reflection that in the United States, there are plays such as McBird, that was by Barbara Garson, or The Midlothian Mirror, that's Penn Jones' book and newspaper that he was publishing, that have suggested that the vice president was trying to catch the nearest way to the White House. Most Americans would no more suspect Lyndon Johnson of complicity in the assassination of John Kennedy than suspect Andrew Johnson in the complicity in the murder of Lincoln. Nevertheless, the political motivation by forces behind the scenes, behind Lyndon Johnson, the cabinet, the Pentagon, the Navy Intelligence, the Defense Intelligence Agency, those behind the scenes cannot be dismissed, and those who accomplished the deed may well have intended the consequences. Many an American has thought as much, but hardly dared to dwell on the thought, much less speak out. The thought is repellent. And he says that it wasn't only Lyndon Johnson, the man who inherited the throne. That's why he disagreed with Shriver. He said it isn't just that one person who inherits it. It's the people behind that person. So Lyndon Johnson went off in disgrace down to his ranch and really was never seen publicly much after he was out of office in 1968. But the team that killed him stayed into power, and they're into power today. And Ronald Reagan's gang, the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Pentagon, the Hoover Institute, the think tanks, and the Georgetown University, those people all had a finger in the pie going back 17 years ago. Some of the younger people coming in didn't have a finger in that pie, but they did nothing ever to investigate it. And the point is that the old-timers, such as John Connally, Gerald Ford, Richard Nixon — Nixon was out on an atomic submarine this week, acting every bit the political man interested in the weapon systems and the military. The guy should have been sent to an island like Alba somewhere. He is taken out by the military and given a lot of dignity. Now, I mentioned briefly another coup, an interesting one, because this Richard Allen had a part as an agent in Portugal, and with problems in Africa at the time of trying to throw Portugal out of the colonies down there. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal about Richard Allen. And before the Reagan administration could take over, there was a military coup yesterday in Guinea-Bissau in West Africa. President Luis de Almeida Cabral was arrested and taken into custody. His brother was murdered a few years earlier, and it's just a little country. It may not mean much to you, Portuguese Guiana. It belonged to Portugal. They got their independence in 1974. It's about twice the size of New Jersey. But it's a country that has, in quotes, peanuts, and peanut oil is very important, palm oil, hides, a large deposit of bauxite, and traces of oil. This poor man was picked up by the military, taken off. His brother was murdered in 1973. He was the first president. His brother was murdered. And now the president has been taken off. There was a lot of guerrilla warfare in fighting the Portuguese, and Richard Allen had a big part in suppressing certain massacres down in Africa that involved Portugal. He was a lobbyist for Portugal. If the United States needs minerals, if it needs oil, if it needs hides, if it needs a bauxite, it's going to go in and take it. And you're going to see more military juntas, more coups coming in, even before Ronald Reagan takes his oath of office. But once he's in, there will be a lot of it. The last week I mentioned, I don't want to get too far off some of these unpleasant subjects, but I did mention a book on the Nobel, the Russian Rockefellers, and the study of history of how we got, say, from the Civil War up to the Ronald Reagan period. There's a linear connection between events and people and agents that goes back to the way the world was shaped in terms of trade and business at the time of the American Civil War. I have a book in my library by Foster Rhea Dulles. He's the brother of John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles. Two men that were so instrumental in setting up all the failures that we've had internationally and domestically over this whole era of the last 30 years. And he wrote a book on American diplomatic history from 1860 to 1900. Now, it's interesting that the brother of John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles would write about this time period, because he wrote a book from the Civil War to the 20th century. It's called Prelude to World Power, and it's about the foundations that were laid after Lincoln's time period and Secretary of State William Seward, and the intent to make the United States an international world power, trading and arousing imperialism that we never had had before, that we were going to stop France or Napoleon into Mexico, we're going to stop Spain, we're going to stop Great Britain. There seemed to be a fluctuating of power from Russia wanting to assist the North, the Union, and Abraham Lincoln to become industrialized to compete with Great Britain and Spain and France. And then after Lincoln was killed, the Tsar was killed, and Britain and France and England could control pretty much the trade routes. And after the Russian Revolution, and end of World War I, the empires, the royalty began to rearm again to keep down any expansion of Russia or to stop the promotion of the ideas that the Russian Marxists had taken on that they might possibly spread around the world. And so the monarchies and the wealthy countries began to put in Adolf Hitler and Mussolini, hoping that the dictators would keep a handle on these obstinate new Soviets who came out with a new idea of dividing up the means of employment and the ownership of the factories by the people. The work of the Russians at the time of Abraham Lincoln's administration and the death of the leaders in Russia and the United States affected a lot of the policy that's going on today. We were starting out right at that time to expand and become an empire, and that's the thing we were never taught in school, at least I was never taught, was the diplomatic history, such as the 1860s to 1900, that set the framework for World War One in 1914, for World War II that we entered in 1941, but actually began in 1939 when Hitler went into Poland. But the seeds of it were laid much earlier. These wars, World War One, Two, and Three, were planted, and the idea of them, of grabbing empire or territory, was always in the minds of a few people. And those who go out and fight, if they survive, they join the American Legion. If they die, they can't talk anyway. The only difference between those wars and the next one is the atomic proliferation, or the chance of the wars in space, or the laser beams and the weapon systems that are going to be, they are developed now, that are going to be deployed. We're working with a bunch of idiots, I believe, who don't know what they're doing or why, except they have it in their head that they have to make war, and they have to make war against Russia. And those are the people that I'll be discussing for weeks and weeks to come, members of Ronald Reagan's cabinet, from the Georgetown University, from Harvard, from the Hoover Institute, the proliferation of weapons, the reduction of domestic programs, the curtailing of things that are going on that would benefit us, and how these people have run a thread, like John J. McCloy, Gerald Ford, Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger. They never faded away or died away. They had unlimited funds. They stayed powerful. They stayed in the media. And they're going to affect our lives until at some point we hurt enough, if we feel anything at all, to speak out and cry out. And if we don't feel it, we won't know the difference anyway. But it's a dismal future with the advisors that Reagan has, but it's something that we'll continue to study, and I'll be harping on it a lot because it goes back again to the assassination of John Kennedy, where many of these people were employed either as part of the assassination team or the cover-up. Well, another week has gone by. You take care. Next week or the week after is Thanksgiving. Have some good holidays, because by next Sunday I won't be able to reach some of you in the East by then. Continue to study and read your books and keep in touch, and I'll be back with you next week. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California.
This has been World Watchers International with noted conspiracy investigator Mae Brussel.